Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and start up the Senate Judiciary Committee. We have a number of bills for public hearing, and it looks like we have a lot of interest in at least two of those bills, and so we're going to need to try to manage our time a little bit more efficiently than maybe on some other days. Not that we're not efficient, but we may need to be a little tighter on how much time for testimony. I know I have Senator Boquist here. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on the purpose to take Senator Boquist's testimony at this point. And so that's going to be on Senate Bill 504. Brian, why don't you go ahead and get situated. Welcome back. We wish you were here on this side instead of that side, but we'll take you whenever we can get you.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair Cruz, I appreciate Vice Chair Cruz is sitting there, not me. Having said that, though, Mr. Chair, colleagues, very briefly, and I will be brief, I'm passing around to you the typical legislative council notes that you get when you get a bill draft. And you'll happen to note that neither one of them are the bill you're looking before, because the bill that you are looking at, 504, this is the third iteration of it going around in 3 years. And in a nutshell, from my experience on judiciary, the one observation I have in the drunk driving issue is that in four sessions, I voted six times to do something with the drunk driving statutes because it wasn't working. And I raised last time with Bill Taylor, last time around the administrator then, and with several of the other legal counsels, and said very simply, what can we do in terms of drunk driving that we aren't doing now, that doesn't cost a lot of money because we can't afford more police, because we can't afford to put more people in jail? And in a nutshell, what we came up with is, well, maybe enforce the existing laws. As you all know, we have an existing law right now in which the breathalyzer device and the lock system is in the law, and unfortunately we still have people who are driving a third and fourth time and killing people on the roads. And so what I did is I, of course, then went to legislative council and asked them, okay, we ought to have this as mandatory maybe in the second or third time. And they came back and said, of course, it's already mandatory in the second or third time, but the judges aren't doing it. So here we are back again. I had a discussion with the Department of Transportation, DMV, so on and so forth, and there's flaws even in this bill that would need to be amended to make it more efficient. But the goal here is the same goal that I asked legislative council three sessions ago to do, is let's identify something in the interlock system where the criminal who has committed the crime for the second or third time has to pay the way, has to pay the freight, and we don't bog up the court system, but we solve the drunk driving issue. And again, Mr. Chairman, colleagues, I think I voted no less than six times in four sessions on versions of the drunk driving law to make it tighter. And we keep coming back to the same thing. Here's another idea. I think, Mr. Chair, you and I talked about this last session. This bill is not perfect. It's got a few errors because DMV has pointed it out. Be happy to work with whomever. But again, what I was looking for was a solution that addresses the issue that the criminal is going to pay for and not the state. And it then finally gets some more of them off the road. Be happy to entertain any questions, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Senator, one of the things that we did talk about last session was actually having the interlock apply based on a conviction on the first. I understand from speaking to council that there is some bills that are on the House side that are being worked that may be more expansive. I can tell the committee might, based on the conversations we had before, I told this committee that we would, in fact, address this issue. So I'm going to hold on to the bill. We're going to take questions, and we're going to hold on to it because it has a very nice relating clause that I can put in there, which not in yours, but we will put in there, that would be applicable to first convictions for the interlock.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm open to anything that addresses the issue that's fair both on both sides of the event. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And any questions for the Senator? Brian, thank you very much. All right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and close this public hearing for a moment. I'll tell you what, let's go ahead and take the other two that are listed here. Ann Pratt, why don't you come on up, and Amy Joyce. And just make certain, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 504? If you do, please raise your hand so I know that you're out there. Morning, Ann.
Morning. Good morning, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Crime Victims United, and the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. And all three organizations wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 504. And also asked to let you know that the OAA is also in full support. And I want to say thank you to Senator Boquist, I think he left, but for bringing this bill forward. It has been proven that ignition interlocks greatly reduce repeat DUI offenses by 67% and can save hundreds or thousands of lives and still give offenders the ability to drive without endangering the rest of us. They can legally drive, go to work, carry on with their lives, all the while retraining their risky behavior. New Mexico saw a 35% reduction in DUI crashes and fatalities. Offenders themselves believe interlocks are fair and an effective sanction. According to a study conducted by Richard Roth of New Mexico, one of the nation's leading authorities on ignition interlocks, the offenders themselves said 83% believe interlocks are very effective in preventing them from drunk driving. 88% believe interlocks are very helpful in avoiding another DUI, and 72% believe that all offenders should have interlocks. But the first step is getting them on. When we worked with Senator Shields in 07 to improve our interlock bill, we thought it would help prevent these offenders from waiting out the then 6 month requirement. So we changed it to 1 year for the first offense, 2 years for the second offense. While it did help, I believe it was like about 10%, we still have a problem. And we need to get these interlocks on the vehicles first. According to DMV, only about 35% who are ordered to install actually are in compliance. In the handout that I gave you, that is the MAD handout, on the back is the sheet of those, the 9,000 who are ordered and the 3,000 who actually comply. They waited out. 65% of these offenders are escaping through this loophole in the law. All they have to do is wait it out, then go in and reinstate their Oregon driver's license. All the while, they are driving while suspended. According to MAD, up to 75% of these type of offenders do drive anyway, because they can, and we need to stop this. We have an ignition interlock law for a very valid reason. IIDs have proven to save lives and reduce the instances of drunk driving in America. From 2004 to 2008, the number of fatalities in New Mexico dropped 35% because of the use of interlocks. I believe Senate Bill 504 will help persuade the majority of these offenders to comply with the law. It makes no sense to have a life-saving bill such as this on the books and let the offender slip out through a loophole. Please support Senate Bill 504. Thank you.
Thank you. Amy?
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the the Department of Transportation representing DMV. You have my written testimony. Understanding the chair's direction when Senator Boquist was testifying, I will just make 2 points. The bill is drafted. Does have a potential loophole. I've already discussed with Senator Boquist, but I understand that work probably will be done on the bill, and that doing something of this nature does have a fiscal impact associated with it to the DMV. But you have my written testimony, and I won't belabor that, so if you have any questions.
All right, thank you. And we'll be working through council. Aaron will be kind of the point person for the committee on this bill as we do the rewrites. Any questions? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 504, and we're going to go ahead and open up our work session that was scheduled for the first of the day, which is Senate Bill 383. Aaron?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 383 allows the initial or secondary notice of residential defect to be sent by certified mail. It exempts small claims and counterclaims relating to the contract for construction, alteration, or repair of a residence, a component or material incorporated into a residence from this notice requirement.
All right. Anyone else need any more information? If not, the chair will take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 383 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 383 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions? Any objections? So ordered. And do we have a volunteer for this one? Senator Dingfelter, will you be so kind?
Sure.
We'll close the work session with Senate Bill 383. And at this point, we're going to go ahead and go back to the top of the agenda for the public hearings. And just make certain Senator Shields has not made it in the room. And I don't see him, so we'll go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 69.
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. Senate Bill 69 pretty much does a wholesale revision to the portions of the Oregon statutes pertaining to the sale, possession, use, and explosion of fireworks. There are a large number of grammatical and substantive changes, and it's important for the committee to know that a fairly substantial amendment has been released and should be in front of you. The high points include changes to the level of penalty for infractions involving less than 50 pounds gross weight of illegal fireworks to a violation carrying a maximum fine of $720. More than 50 becomes a Class A misdemeanor carrying a maximum penalty of 1 year's imprisonment, $6,250 fine or both. Change by lengthening of the duration of the retail permitting application process, and an exception to allow enumerated businesses to utilize fireworks to frighten off animals in some circumstances.
All right, thank you. It looks like we have a request for order of present presenters. So I'm going to go ahead and call up Paul Rondell, Roger Martin, and shall you come on up. We'll just do these two, then I've got the panel of three after that. Gentlemen, whoever wants to start first, if you'll just put your name on the record, and we'll take your testimony.
Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, my name is Paul Wendell. I'm a lieutenant with the Beaverton Police Department.
Thank you.
I just have a few short comments today, and I appreciate your time. For the past year, as one representative of several law enforcement agencies participating on a fireworks law review committee hosted by the State Fire Marshal's Office. And our goal, at least for the portion of law enforcement, was every year local law enforcement deals with a number of calls for service involving fireworks. The majority of these calls are handled by officers with discretion and with the cooperation of those we're in contact with. However, when we determined that enforcement action is necessary, we do not have a state statute that provides clear direction to officers on the street and does not provide them with a level of enforcement that generally mirrors the level of offense that the officers are dealing with. Our only enforcement action at this time is to make a misdemeanor arrest and send those individuals to district court on a criminal charge. As a result, officers rarely take enforcement action other than to seize illegal fireworks and move on to the next call for service. Senate Bill 69 provides us with an enforcement tool where law enforcement can cite and release individuals when deemed appropriate at a violation level. This will allow us to take reasonable enforcement action and properly address the needs of all citizens in the community. And just for reference, in the city of Beaverton, we average between 60 to 100 calls for service, fireworks-related calls for service on a 4th of July evening. And as stated, the majority of those calls are handled only in a situation where we seize the fireworks and then we move on. It's very difficult for officers to make a criminal arrest for possession of illegal fireworks at this time, as the officers don't feel that that level of enforcement matches what they're seeing in the calls for service. And so that's why Beaverton Police Department participated, and we support law enforcement's efforts to bring a appropriate level of enforcement to Senate Bill 69. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, Paul, if you just hang on. Roger, why don't you give us your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Golf Association. We have a very small 3 or 4 line part in this bill, but it's an important part. Golf courses, like many other cultural, and you'll hear this from others, need to use fireworks occasionally to chase away waterfowl, specifically Canadian geese. We have a huge increase in population. I'm a lifelong waterfowl observer, I call it. I actually am a duck hunter, but I do more observing than hunting. We have a tremendous increase in Canadian geese subspecies in the state of Oregon. And they love grass, and they love golf courses, and they can do huge damage. Golf courses use an array of things, dogs if they have them available, and other things to try to just move the birds away. We're not killing anything, we just want to move them away to keep them from damage they do. This bill gives us the application method to properly apply for the use of fireworks under a well-observed regulation, which I think is very good. I want to end by complimenting the state fire marshal's office. They got out early and contacted people all over the state who might be affected by this bill 7 or 8 months ago last summer to tell us what they were doing, so we had time to look at it, and I think that's a very good thing, and they should be complimented for it. And I urge you, after you have amended the bill where you need to pass it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for either of us? Thank you, gentlemen. Our next panel is going to be Howard Greer, Aaron Jansons, and Anita Phillips. Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 69? Okay. Oh, yeah, I've got two. I'm sorry. Whoever would like to get started, if you would give us your name, please.
Okay. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Jansons. I'm the fire marshal for the City of Portland. As you know, Senate Bill 69 amends fireworks statute ORS 480.120. It was created from a wide cross-section of citizens, fireworks professionals, and a variety of agencies, including fire and police. Excuse me. In Portland, our difficulty is many of the fireworks that are illegal in Portland are legal in Washington and readily available to anybody who can drive across the Columbia. Portland Fire and Rescue, I'd like to add, appreciates the professional displays in our region. These are well-planned events conducted by professionals in low-hazard areas and are permitted through our office. And they're also advertised so that they're predictable to their neighbors. Still, people wishing to avoid the noise of these explosions want to be able to plan and to protect themselves and their loved ones. The real consequences of fireworks are physical, emotional, environmental, and economic costs, which escalate when illegal fireworks end up in the hands of amateurs. Fireworks represent an enormous hazard to parks, forests, and the wildlife living there, in addition to people and property that we normally associate that. Illegal fireworks cause countless injuries, including trauma and burns from unplanned explosions, enormous property loss each year, causing fires to residents, landscape, and wildland, emotional trauma to young children and animals who are especially vulnerable, environmental pollution measurable in both air and noise, and despite being viewed as patriotic, fireworks are a source of recurring trauma to many of our returning war veterans. Portland Fire and Rescue has invested in an operation, Lower the Boom. This is to address illegal fireworks, and it includes a public information campaign, a non-emergency number for citizens to call and report illegal activity, and then we work with Portland Police to confiscate and fine individuals. Unfortunately, the response necessary, our resources are overwhelmed by the response necessary to do this effectively. People should be able to trust their neighbors and obey the laws and not place them in jeopardy through this illegal activity. Our goal for Portland Fire and Rescue is to make the 4th of July safe and enjoyable for all. Supporting Senate Bill 69 will help keep neighborhoods safe and pleasant for all by providing tools to law enforcement to use on those bringing illegal fireworks to Oregon. I appreciate your support.
All right, thank you. Whoever would like to go next?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Howard W. Greer. I am a detective with the Oregon State Police. I work with the counterterrorism section in both the arson and explosives units. I have submitted written testimony in favor of this Senate bill. I will therefore keep my comments brief. I am here to represent arson investigators and bomb technicians in the state of Oregon. We are involved in, intimately in fireworks-related investigations involving both criminal and non-criminal incidents where people are injured or fire claims property or persons. The part of the unit's task is to collect illegal fireworks throughout the state. We conduct disposal operations at the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue Facility near Wilsonville on a regular basis and destroy hundreds of pounds of fireworks. This particular procedure, while done on a relatively routine basis, is very hazardous to the bomb technicians who are conducting this disposal operation. In summary, we are supporting this Senate bill for the very simple fact that we would like to see consistency throughout the state. As it stands right now, patrol officers are very reluctant to charge individuals caught with illegal fireworks, for example, one bottle rocket, one firecracker, one Roman candle, with a misdemeanor offense. We are seeking consistency by downgrading this particular offense to a violation level in aid of consistent enforcement. I would love to address your questions at this point in time, sir.
All right, thank you. And Anita.
Chip Lozanski, members of the committee. My name is Anita Phillips. I am the licensing manager with the Office of State Fire Marshal. Just to hit on a couple points, you do have the written testimony. I wanted to tell you why we developed this legislative concept. We've had numerous citizen complaints of illegal fireworks, especially right after the 4th of July. We've had inquiries from legislators regarding constituent complaints of illegal fireworks, statements from law enforcement and prosecutors regarding unclear fireworks statutes and lack of enforcement tools. We also, as mentioned earlier, we need to try to get agricultural fireworks in the statute so that the small businesses can protect their property from geese and other birds that are causing damage. And then the last thing is the retail sales application. We'd like to move that up from the current 15 days to 30 days so that we can get the permits out earlier to the wholesalers and we can kind of help them move things along. The impacts of this bill are that clearer statutes, less confusing for those enforcing it. Law enforcement will have, and courts will have a better opportunity to regulate illegal fireworks. As I just said, golf courses and landfills and other businesses can have an opportunity to use these to control damaging birds. We want to make sure that the statutes will make a fair playing field for all. And what I also wanted to let you know is this bill does not have any financial impact on the fireworks industry, their customers, or small businesses. It does not increase any fees or have any fiscal impact at all. And it does not increase regulation on the fireworks industry or their customers. That's all I have, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Senator Wissett.
Thank you. I haven't had time to read the amendment, which apparently replaces the bill. In the original bill, I believe in Section 8, it provides that the fire marshal would be able to establish their own, by rule, their own fees, and that makes it an automatic no for me. So, I mean, I don't know if it's in the new bill or not. The second question is to the Portland Fire Marshal. It's my understanding that you said that fireworks available in Washington are illegal in Oregon?
Correct.
I wonder if you could document for the committee the problems currently occurring in Washington as a result of their lack of regulation of some types of fireworks that are illegal in Oregon.
They also have difficulties with all of the problems that I cited with the increase of fires, the emotional trauma to the children, animals, to returning veterans of war.
I appreciate that. I wonder if you could document that for the committee, or for me personally at least. The documentation that you base that assumption on.
Sure.
Please, thank you.
Absolutely.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. Appreciate your testimony today. Senator Schultz, I have two other, or maybe three other people that need to testify on this. Do you have about 5 minutes? or do you need to, I can take your testimony out of order and come back to that one.
Would you mind, Mr. Chair?
I have no problem. We're going to take a recess on Senate Bill 69. I'm going to open up a hearing for public hearing on Senate Bill 524 for the purpose of taking Senator Shields' testimony, and then we'll come back and finish this. Why don't we just go ahead and framework, go ahead and put something on, and we'll have that.
All right. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 524 exempts certain individuals who provide mental health treatment or substance abuse disorder treatment from an existing plenary disqualification on the receipt of public funds on the basis of prior conviction. It requires the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority to maintain a record of fitness determination if the individual requests it and to disclose that information upon that individual's request.
All right. Just for everyone to understand what we're doing, Senator Shields has other obligations in the building, so it's routine that we do take members' testimony out of order when they need to go back to their other assignments. So, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent Senate District 22 in North and Northeast Portland, and I'm here to introduce Senate Bill 524, which I support. For most of my professional life, I've been working with people in recovery from addiction, people who've been in trouble with the law, with an organization that I founded called Better People. And when I started Better People, I was also in graduate school in the PSU School of Social Work and had an opportunity to do my practicum at Volunteers of America Men's Residential Center in North and Northeast Portland. And the person who supervised my work in that program was an incredible man named Al Forten, and he was a very big man with big ideas that he could help a lot of people enter the recovery lifestyle. He wasn't always the positive influence on North and Northeast Portland that he was when I met him around 2001. In fact, he was a very bad man and a very scary man, and was one of the bigger drug dealers in North and Northeast Portland for a very long time, and also involved in all that that entails, including having to do some pretty significant stints in the state correctional system. The reason why I think this bill is important, and I think the committee passed around Al Forten's story, it's entitled Street Smarts Making a Difference. His story illustrates why this bill is important, in that it's not absolutely critical that someone walked in a person's shoes in order to help them get to recovery, but it often can be an important tool to help people get into recovery, meaning that people, addicts can often look at somebody like Al and say, look, if that guy can do it, certainly I can do it. And Al failed in treatment numerous times. A lot of people now take solace in his story. In fact, the last time I was at Volunteers of America, two people who were actually our clients in that group were now working for Volunteers of America. And the reason Senate Bill 524 is important is because under current law, Al Forten would not be able to provide addictions or mental health services after June 30th, 2011. Senate Bill 524 would exempt mental health and addictions workers from the list of permanently, and that's the important word, permanently disqualifying crimes in ORS 443.004. And I would bring this bill forward because I think it's important that there should be a weight test that would be reinstated with this bill as well, so that after somebody's done their time, got clean and sober, exhibited all kinds of pro-social endeavors in the community, that they should be able to reach back and bring somebody else along with them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Shields, I support the concept here. When I was in treatment, the best counselors were people who had been there. And there's no question about that. I guess I'm going to need to look at all the... There's a long list of crimes here, and some may be appropriate and some may not. But my question for you is...
I'm just looking.
Right. My question to you is, would you be willing to just do it for A&D facilities and not mental health facilities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that's a very good question. If you look at OWL's history, this, if it was just for A&D, that might have helped him if he would have stayed in his current position. If he would have gone to, for example, Cascadia Mental Health Facility, which does a lot of drug and alcohol treatment on an outpatient basis and does mental health, he would have been restricted from moving and progressing up, going back to get a licensed clinical social worker degree to provide that mental health counseling. And when so many of the people in who have addictions have dual diagnosis or comorbidities, and there's more blurring of that, and there will be even more after we get through healthcare reform, that I think that that I think the weighted test would be appropriate for people in those situations. I would hate to have somebody like Al go back and get a an advanced degree and not be able to provide cognitive behavioral therapy to people who have both addictions problems and some mental health issues.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. We'll talk about it. It would be nice to be able to coalesce around something that might actually pass. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It might pass. In the Chair's opinion, it will pass. All right. Senator Dean Filbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Shields. I just want to note that I was a co-sponsor of the original bill last session, House Bill 2442, and I think there were some unintended consequences, fortunately, that I heard about during the interim. So I appreciate you bringing forward Senate Bill 524, and hopefully it'll pass in some form to address this concern, because I did hear during the interim from constituents that had concerns. They supported the underlying premise of House Bill 2442, but were concerned that it would exclude some very qualified people from working in the field. So I thank you for bringing this forward.
Thanks. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
we're going to go ahead and recess on 524 for the purpose of reopening the Senate Bill 69's testimony. So we'll reopen 69. And I have three people that are on the list at this point: Sean Cleave, John McCulley, and Dave Barrows. And if someone else wanted to give testimony, okay. Gentlemen, I'm going to have Dave go first. Looks like Sean and John are kind of like, we're not sure if we're against it or neutral, so you're on the fence, so we'll put you in the second spot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Dave Barrows. I'm here today representing American Promotional Events, which is the largest seller of retail fireworks in Oregon. As Roger Martin indicated, there has been a lot of discussion in the interim, and we honor the Fire Marshal's office for bringing all the parties into the room around the table. And we're here today to support this bill and the Dash 1 amendments. So that's our testimony, and we are supportive of it as this portion of the industry.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Brzezanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. The Oregon Farm Bureau supports the Dash 1 amendments. There were some issues with Section 9 of the bill as it affects agricultural producers and their use of aerial fireworks as a deterrent for birds. I'd like to thank the Fire Marshal for working with the Farm Bureau and other agricultural interests to address the issues that we identified, and those have all been incorporated into the Dash 1, so we can definitely support the Dash 1 amendments to this bill. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley. I'm here today representing the tree fruit industry, which are pear, cherry, apple growers in the Columbia River area and also in northeastern Oregon. Like Mr. Cleave, we support the Dash 1 amendments. They address the issues that we raised with the Fire Marshal's office, and I have to compliment the Fire Marshal's office for their response to our concerns. I think that the bill with the Dash 1 amendments is ready to go.
All right. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you come on up. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on 69? When you're ready.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Adam Walsh. I'm with the City of Eugene. Our council taken a position of support on the original bill, having just received the amendments. We'll send it to staff, but we are supportive for the clarification that it provided for our ability to enforce fireworks violations. So I just wanted to share that with the committee.
All right, great. Thank you very much. Last time, anyone want to testify on 69? Close that public hearing. We're going to reopen the public hearing where we just started prior to this on Senate Bill 524. And I need to have the list of the sign-up sheets, Pam. All right, we have a number of people who want to give testimony today. And I apologize, I'm going to try to pronounce the names correctly, but since they're written out, some of them may not be quite as legible for me, but let's go ahead and we're going to do panels of three. Megan, I've got two Megans, Moyer, and then Cole Hogg?
The other Megan, whoever the other Megan is,
I apologize. And Jim Whipple? Why don't you be our first of our three panels.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. I'm here representing a variety of different CIU members, from nonprofit mental health and addiction workers to state hospital workers to the workers in the Department of Human Services Criminal Background Check Unit. Senate Bill 524 is drafted in order to address a very serious issue that has come up from ORS 443.004, which is the inclusion of mental health and addiction workers in the list of workers who are subject to the list of permanently disqualifying crimes. And the issues that have come up to SEIU over the past 2 years have been significant in the mental health and addictions field. We have had quality mental health and addiction providers who have been working in the field often for decades face the inability to change their job when they applied for a new job, termination due to a history that of either mental illness or addiction in their past that led them at times to be involved in the criminal justice system. I think what I want to spend my time, since I've done written testimony and there's lots of people, is simply just to focus on why SEIU supports the inclusion of mental health workers. This is an area of debate that many people have brought up, and SEIU does strongly support the inclusion of mental health workers in this exemption because we believe that it is equally as important to have the values of recovery and hope and the belief that somebody can reach a better place and give back to their community in the mental health system as well as in the addiction system. People with severe mental illness oftentimes end up not being able to get the care they need until, unfortunately, they enter the door of the criminal justice system. Sometimes they're connected to their local mental health organizations, and sometimes they end up in the state hospital. But it is central toward the recovery process for people to believe that they can change their lives, that there is something better for them, and often to help people see this as a real possibility for themselves, it is helpful to have people in the workforce who have personal experience with this. There's evidence-based practices around peer-delivered supports, and we would not want to limit that just to settings like AA, but also in being able to seek counseling, have employees at the state hospital, and other settings where people can display that they have been a success story. Certainly, SEIU in no way wants to undermine the safety of vulnerable
vulnerable individuals, which is why we are very supportive of a weigh test, also known as a fitness determination, that does take into account several factors, such as what was the crime, the instance of the crime, the vulnerability of the individuals receiving care, the length of time since conviction, and what an individual has done since that time to prove that they are an appropriate person to be working in a particular setting. We take risked individuals very seriously and believe that fitness determinations have a long history in the state of Oregon of doing appropriately assessing somebody's fitness in the setting. And in fact, if anything, I think that having spoken to the workers at the background check unit, they take their responsibility for the vulnerability of the people getting care more seriously than they would weigh extenuating circumstances. So I strongly support allowing addictions and mental health workers to go back to a fitness determination so that we aren't losing excellent mental health and addiction professionals without any level of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so Megan and Jim, you're both from Benton County, so I'm going to let you all speak in whatever order you want.
Okay.
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Megan Cahay. I thank you for this opportunity to testify in favor and support of Senate Bill 524. I'm representing Benton County Health Services, which is in favor, and also I'm president of Mental Health America of Oregon, which is also in favor. It's my honor at Benton County to be the peer wellness coordinator. And what I have done is created a peer specialist support training and program, which the way it works is people who have serious mental health issues but who are in recovery go through a training, a 66-hour training, and then are able once they pass some certain criteria to be in the workforce helping our peers in the clinical setting of the mental health system. So first of all, let me say I myself have a history of serious mental health issues and many hospitalizations, and this is the first time in my life I've worked in a full-time job. And there was a time when I myself made some bad choices and did a criminal act, and that gratefully is in my past. But and anyway, I'm very glad that I'm able to do this work. And the fact that I did go through that and emerge from that and became very dedicated to turning my life into a better way of serving my peers and the community, I've been able to have a very gratifying job and help other people, which makes a huge difference both for me and for the community and hopefully for the state. So let me just say in my work, I have seen employees who have had trouble passing a criminal background check. Jim Whipple is here with me here today. He will testify about his own personal story. And I would like to say that there are individuals that I know in Benton County today who have serious criminal histories, including murder, and that was very far in their past, and I've seen them work on the recovery in very vigorous and convincing ways. And the person I'm thinking of in particular would love to be a peer wellness specialist, and yet she's been not wanting to take the training because she didn't believe she could pass a background test. And I have no worry at all that she would not be a wonderful peer specialist. People like her and myself and Jim were able to tell people we've been through the fire and come out the other side, and it's possible to do the same, and we're a source for hope and inspiration for our peers. Thank you very much for allowing me this opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Jim.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. Due to youth bipolar disorder and substance use.
Jim, I need you to put your name on the record.
My name is Jim Whipple.
All right, thank you. And that microphone, if you can pull it down just a little bit, just make it. There you go. Thank you.
due to youth, bipolar disorder, and substance abuse early in my life led me to make poor choices, and I ended up with a criminal record. Since that time, I turned my life around and desired to work in the field of mental health, and I took peer specialist training with Megan at Benton County Health Department. Afterwards, I had to take a criminal background check to be able to work, and I did not pass the criminal background check, and I was very disappointed. Megan and the director of the health department convinced me to appeal the decision, and it was denied a second time, and finally it was approved the third time, and the process was very difficult and disheartening, and I very likely could have given up, but due to encouragement I kept going. Two years later, I'm working full time as a certified peer specialist. I'm the lead worker there, and my life has a deep sense of meaning and purpose due to being given this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward and sharing your stories. Our next panel is going to be Lynn Ray, Eric Martin, and Linda Kraft Coleman, please. And whoever would like to get started, if you just put your name on the record and then take your testimony.
Sir. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Len Ray, and I'm the administrator for Adult Mental Health Services with Addictions and Mental Health. I'd like to take a few minutes to provide the committee a little bit of information. The division is neutral on this bill, and the information that I would like to provide is that, as been stated, during the special February 2010 session, there was a temporary modification to H. Bill 2442 that was implemented and that will sunset July 1st of this year. And this bill makes the exemption permanent, as has been said. The bill seeks to permanently change statutory language, excluding employees of an A&D residential treatment facility or residential treatment home from this exclusionary list of crimes. As we all know, there are many people in recovery who have had crimes in their past history, and this factor alone isn't a reasonable basis to deny employment, since many individuals who are successful in recovery are exactly the best individuals to be providing treatment. As we look at developing a transformed healthcare system, I think that for addictions and mental health, the use of peer supports, the use of peer mentors and recovery coaches are really instrumental and key to both providing the necessary services and using dollars in the most expeditious manner. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Whoever would like to go next.
Hi, Chair Przanski and committee members. My name is Eric Martin, and I'm the past president and director of the Addiction Counselor Certification Board of Oregon. I'm the current policy director at the certification board. I served on the Governor's Council on Substance Abuse Programs and the Governor's Advisory Board on Drugs and Violent Crime. I've been working in addiction treatment for the last 26 years. Over the last decade, the number of African-American counselors applying for certification has declined. 20 years ago, 4.5% of counselors in Oregon were African-American, and now among new applicants in 2010, that number has dropped to 1%. Criminal prohibitions are having a chilling effect on minorities entering the addiction treatment field. The number of recovering people has dropped dramatically. Back in the 1980s, about 80% of addiction counselors were in recovery, and that has dropped down below one-third. Criminal prohibitions are a big part of the reason why this is occurring, and I think that part of the problem that you may not completely understand is the reclassification of a lot of addiction treatment clients into the mental health system. Many addiction treatment centers are now co-licensed for mental health. There has been a huge expansion and reclassification of addiction treatment clients and people in society in general. According to one of the federal government's largest studies, 57% of Americans now have a lifetime ever mental health disorder. So apparently more than half of the committee and those of us in this room are now mentally ill. With this huge reclassification, part of the nomenclature of the federal government has invented new terminology like SPMI and SMI. So they're classifying folks with mental disorders as serious persistent mental illness or serious mental illness because of this huge breadth of reclassification. Well, with this reclassification, with more and more addiction treatment clients having co-occurring disorders, that now disqualifies many recovering people and minorities from working in the treatment field. And I will say that treatment will not work without minority counselors and without recovering counselors. All the education in the world is great, and I appreciate education as much as anybody, but in general, the public values experience. If I asked you who is the spokesperson for Subway sandwiches, most of you in this room would say, well, that's Jared. And if I said, well, does Jared have a master's degree in nutrition? Where does Jared get off giving us advice about what we should eat? He does not. He's not a dietitian. He doesn't have a graduate degree in nutrition. He has experience. And the American public values experience. You're going to hear testimony from a bunch of African-American counselors, and most of them have offenses that range from 20 to 40 years ago. And all of them have suffered over the last decade. And to many of us that are sort of affluent, being off work for 4 to 6 weeks may not be that big of a deal. But for those of us that work in the alcohol and drug treatment field, which is a low-income field, 4 to 6 weeks is just enough to become homeless. So many of us that work in the treatment field live literally just, you know, one paycheck from poverty. So I hope you keep your ears open and you listen to these folks' stories, because this is a really, really important issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda.
Yes. Thank you. My name is Linda Kraft Coleman, and I'm here because I have a personal story that I want to share. I'm a longtime member in the recovering community, which means that I have several years. Actually, I have 21 years, 6 months, and 3 days clean. And I have been able to come back into the society that I took from and become a productive member. And I did that because I asked, what can I do? And people like you, people that helped me and mentored me, said, you got to go back to school, you got to get some education, and you got to become a productive member of society, get a job, pay your taxes, and quit doing crimes. I did that. I went back, I got an associate's, I got a bachelor's in social work at Concordia. I am now in my last term to get my master's degree at PSU in social work. I'll graduate in June 2011. That's huge. That's really huge for me. I'm the first in my family to do such. What I want to let you know is that throughout my course of my recovery, I've been working in this field as an as administrative person, alcohol and drug counselor. I supervise. I've ran programs. I've created programs. But along the way, what has happened is when I am trying to get to a different position, background check comes up. My crimes are more than 20 years old, and I have been able to get the job, but then I'm taking off the job 4 to 6, 8 weeks at a time, which is, it causes a lot of strife in my life, financially, emotionally. I feel hopeless sometimes because it's like, why am I doing all of this? if I have to continue to keep being faced with my criminal record. I could go on and on about my accolades. I've got a CADC2. You know, I sponsor people. I'm on committees. I'm on, you know, I just give back so much because it's my passion and this is what I want to do. And if I'm not allowed to do what I want to do, I don't know. I just don't know. I just need to just say I want to do what I want to do. And I want you to think about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming forward. Any questions? Thank you again for coming forward. All right. I have a representative here who likes to give testimony. Sarah, why don't you go ahead and come up, Representative Gelsler. And then I'm going to bring up with you Ashley Brown, as well as, I believe it's Niba Mustafa. Mustafa, excuse me. Representative, why don't you get it started so you can get back to your other assignments. I assume you have pending.
Great. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing me. I must apologize. I wasn't planning to be here today, but this is a testament to great staff who came and got me out of the Revenue Committee and said, you should go to 343. I wanted to tell you a little bit, first of all, how important this issue is. When we passed House Bill 2442 in 2009, which was a very important bill for protecting some of Oregon's most vulnerable citizens, it was never intended to impact the drug and alcohol community. Never. And that is why in February, many of you will remember, I worked very, very hard to ensure that this was not implemented. So we had a temporary fix to this, which we actually ended up amending into the Boost Bill. The issue didn't come to our attention until after the start of the session, so we had to search far and wide to find an appropriate relating clause in order to get that fix. Immediately began working on a permanent fix, which is in the form of House Bill 2460A, which passed off of the House floor and should be in your possession now. House Bill 2460A is nearly identical to the bill that you have in front of you today. It includes the ability to kind of move your fitness determination from one job placement or assignment to the next so you don't have to go through that whole process again. It also exempts the entire drug and alcohol community from the criminal background exclusions that you've heard about. It also addresses all of the dual licensed facilities. So when there is a facility that is serving people that are both diagnosed with a mental health issue and are receiving drug and alcohol treatment, House Bill 2460A addresses that opinion, that issue as well. And I've had distributed to you a copy of a legislative council opinion clarifying that. It's very important that we take care of those duly licensed facilities. Colleagues, House Bill 2460A is very carefully tailored to fit these issues. It moved across the floor of the House. It is critical that we pass this session, and that is why I would urge you to look very carefully at that. There is a bigger issue that underlies all of these, which is that there's a great degree of mobility in these types of jobs, as well as in home care jobs for people that are serving seniors and people with physical and developmental disabilities. And we require people to get a new background check every time. In the original form of House Bill 2442, we had proposed that the Department of Human Services be able to keep the fingerprints of individuals on record if that was the choice of the worker. That way, they would not have to keep going back through this criminal background check over and over and over again. Too often, these workers not only have to take time off work or are delayed being employed, they also have to pay the expense of having this background check over and over and over again. I would strongly urge us to look at that issue in a separate vehicle, but to act as quickly as possible to be able to provide certainty to the A&D system to preserve that workforce and make sure that we are protecting those workers and the quality work that they do. And because of that, I would urge you to take up House Bill 2460A as soon as possible. It is narrowly tailored to this. It does not pick up the entire mental health system, only those that are duly eligible, and I believe that we would have difficulty moving through the House a bill that included exclusions for the entire mental health system that was not linked to A&D, and that's why I believe that 2460 is the better alternative, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. First, any questions for the representative? Thank you very much.
Representative Gelsler, I actually have a
constituent who has kind of fallen into this situation. I wonder if this your bill would cover this. She has a respite care center that she has run for over 20 years successfully in Southern Oregon. In a former life in California, she was driving under the influence of intoxicants and hit a person and killed them. And she was convicted of involuntary manslaughter, which is one of the bills, one of the situations here, which will cause her. Actually, DHS has warned her that they will not be able to renew her license to run the facility. Would this bill fix that problem?
Yes. Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, this bill addresses only the drug and alcohol and mental health treatment programs. It would not address developmental disability programs or respite programs for seniors and people with physical disabilities. However, the way that that could be addressed and how some people have addressed this where they have very long outstanding convictions is to have the record expunged. As soon as the record is expunged, it is as if the crime had never happened and you are no longer subject to the exclusions that are in this bill. And we have seen people in Oregon since the passage of 2442 successfully go through that process.
Yeah, the only caution there, the expungement statute may not provide that relief with this particular crime.
It doesn't.
Okay. All right. Any other questions for the representative? Thank you very much for coming and joining us. And let's see. We are with Ashley's here. And your first name, sir?
It's Nabi.
Nabi? Okay. And it's Mustafa?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So whoever would like to go next, please.
Thank you. Chair Przanski and committee, my name is Ashley Brown, and I have crimes that are 18 years old or older. And since that 18 years, I have worked in co-occurring disorders, addictions counseling. I am a board member of AGBO. I am the executive director of my own nonprofit. I am a homeowner. I am a mother, a grandmother. I am a mentor. And I'm a taxpayer, albeit begrudgingly, I am. And I have been asked to leave the facility for which I worked immediately because of my criminal history after working on my position for over a month. I and my husband had a group home, and we provided services to African-American adolescent males who were adjudicated, identified as gang members or affiliates, and were showing some success in that group home. There were many, many hurdles that we had to overcome, barriers to even begin to provide services there. We were allowed to work under another agency's umbrella to provide those services for these young people, but when applying to do it for ourselves, our criminal history prohibits. Time and again, I have been approved and passed criminal history checks, but there is inconsistency. I am qualified to do work in this field. I have gotten jobs, passed my interviews. I am on the job doing my work, and I am asked to leave immediately because of 18 to 20-year-old history. I am asking that you take serious consideration and maybe even look at a 7-year rule. Thank you.
Thank you. Nabi?
Yes, Chairman Przanski and members of the committee, thank you for letting me come up here and testify. First of all, let me say
have you put your name on the record, please.
Nabi Mustafa.
Thank you.
And pardon, this looks like a hat. It's a kufi. It's a part of my religious practice, so I'm not being disrespectful if I seem like I am. Okay. First of all, let me say I'm a taxpayer too. I'm paying taxes. I'm buying a home. Written three plays. I've managed Miracles for a while. I'm the executive secretary of Ex-Convicts Embracing Life. I've been able to help people when they're going to court, and I've noticed, well, not noticed, I've been involved with people in recovery and seen the progress they were making, and I felt very comfortable going to court and supporting those persons with my presence and with letters. I'm proud of the fact that the Portland Police Department feels comfortable enough to call me when I have clients that are out of bounds or downtown. One of them in particular, I have a pickup truck. I can go down and pick him up and throw his wheelchair in the back and pick him up and keep him from going to a hospital or going to jail. This is in the last 20-plus years, and I haven't had any criminal issues in the last 20-plus years. However, I've had to go through the criminal background unit check at least six times, twice for the same company. I had a very good instructor who made sure I had their credentials. I'm a certified alcohol and drug counselor. I'm a qualified mental health associate. And she told me that I needed to learn how to do certain things, such as doing assessments. And one of the things that can happen as a result of either misunderstanding or how some of these new laws are applied is that you are not permitted to do those kind of things. And so I would like to see, like it has been said, some kind of time limit placed on the these criminal background checks as far as how back you can go. Because if you go back far enough, in the time when I was a problem and a hindrance to the community with the three strikes law that some states have, I would have been still out. I would have struck out. But there are people, and I'm proud to be a part of some of those people who are actually being an asset to Oregon, and it would be just a shame to not allow us to do what we do very well. I'm also wanting to, whatever process that there has, is that it have some kind of input from the public or from people who want to support you, as opposed to simply, and from the employer. Because if an employer wants to hire you and put you in a position, obviously they think that you have some value after going through whatever process that they send you through. So I think that should be given considerable weight in whatever process comes up. And I know you don't want a really cumbersome process, but it's important because lives here are at stake. Right now, the last position I applied for, and at the urging of the person who was doing the hiring, was as a home care worker because I needed to supplement my income. I'm currently working now 2 days a week for Volunteers of America as a counselor. And I worked for a couple of months, and then they told me that I was disqualified because of a criminal background that went back beyond 20 years when they didn't even have computers holding that information. They got it on some kind of disc, I guess, whatever they have it on. But I think that it's not quite fair, and I think that some of the consequences of the laws that have been applied, a lot of them are being misunderstood, but I don't think the consequences are really have been looked at long term and to see or ask questions about how they really affected people. And I can tell you it has had a great effect on me. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I'd be happy for any questions if there's questions.
Appreciate that. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming forward. I have two other people who are scheduled on the sign-up sheet, Harry Watson and Dorothy Holbrook. And is there anyone else who will want to testify on 524? Whoever would like to get started, just to let you know, we have about 17 minutes. I have one other bill I need to hear. So if we could wrap this up in, about between the two of you within 10 minutes, that would be wonderful.
Okay. Good morning, Chairman Prozanski and members of the committee. My name is Dorothy Holbrook, and I am here today to ask you to support SB 524. I am a mother, a grandmother, an upstanding member of my community. I grew up experiencing things no child should have to experience. I survived many kinds of abuse. I self-medicated and continued the cycle of addiction and alcoholism that ran in my family. I ended up committing crimes and going to prison. While there, I completed a drug program and was able to turn my life around. I have not used any mind-altering substances since February 6, 1996. I was able to attend college upon release, and with my education combined with the life experience, I went into the addiction and mental health field. I went from being the problem to being the solution. In 2007, I went to work in a lockdown facility for the criminally insane in Wayne County, where I live. In 2010, my job was over because of House Bill 2442. My past crimes that I had paid for by doing a prison term and by successfully completing 3 years of post-prison supervision suddenly turned into a life sentence without anyone taking into consideration my experience, qualifications, or skills. I feel the people of Oregon have lost a valued employee to help deal with the problem of addiction and mentally unstable people of this state. I have a gift to share. I have a story that often is the same as the people I help. I am a loving, caring, and compassionate person. I understand how scary life can be for a person who hears voices. I know how you can get so depressed you want to take your own life. I know what the loss of hope feels like. I just want to be able to give back to the people who still suffer, the ones who are like I used to be, the ones whose society have put away and say they are not fit to be on the streets, the ones whose own families don't even want them around. So in closing, I ask you to support SB 524. Please let me give back. Let me make a difference in others' lives, and please let me help. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. And Harry?
Yes, I'm Harry Watson, and I'm a recovering addict, and I've been alcohol and drug-free since 1972. I was successfully treated in a peer-oriented program. So pretty much everybody in there was addicts and criminals that was helping the newer ones come in to learn about recovery and get their life on track. When I left out of treatment, I was in construction for a while. I had a carpenter's card, and I ended up hurting my back and ended up seeking to get involved in the addiction treatment field. And so I went to school, and I become a counselor. I've been certified CADC2 for about 15 years. I worked like 12 years in nonprofits and A&D programs. And the past 14 years, I've been working for Multnomah County. I'm a manager at the juvenile detention facility. I'm in support of this bill. I feel, you know, these backgrounds going way back in people's background, had that been going on when I first come around, you know, I wouldn't be in the field today. I don't know where my life would have been. So I feel like many of us, part of the things that make us good counselors is the experiences that we went through with being an addiction and coming out on the other side. The story I would like to tell is about, I was involved with this young woman that had two small children, age 7 and 4, and she was new out of treatment, and she relapsed, and she went back to smoking crack, and, you know, some months later, I heard that she had the two children, 1 7, 1 4, with her in the crack house, and me and another friend of mine, we went and got the children, and, you know, I took them home with me, and I kept them and was their parent with the help of some friends, at least about 9 months by myself. And, you know, I was seeking through CSD to be able to be their foster parent. And so I went to the classes that they set up for me to go to, and I finished all that. And, you know, the people that check you out from CSD, they come to my house, have a big house, 3 bedrooms, you know, that kind of stuff. I have a good income, And I've probably been working over 37 years in a row at different jobs. And so at the end of the day, they decided that they could not let me have the children because I have a narcotics sale from 1972. I've had no criminal involvement since 1972. I feel that, you know, these long looks in people's backgrounds has the ability to mess up a lot of people's lives.
Thank you. Questions?
I just point out that that problem is endemic in the system, and this bill wouldn't fix it, but it is something that needs to be fixed. A case, whether it's founded or not, stays on your record forever in Children's Services.
Watson, if I could ask you, when you were going through the process of trying to become the foster parent of these children, what year was that?
It was about 5 years ago.
Okay, just want to put a preference from 1972 to back to 2006, someplace like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
All right. And then, Ms. Holtberg, in your testimony, you talked about working in a facility in Lane County. Would you mind telling me the name of that facility?
I worked for Shelter Care at the Heron Center.
Yes, thank you very much. Any other questions? Senator Wissett.
I have a question, Council, and on this bill. It's in Section 1(3) C and D. Do these provisions allow the use of public funds to provide treatment without the required licenses or other qualifications? And I wonder if you just research that for us.
Okay, I'll look into that. And Chair Przanski, members of the committee, just at first blush, I don't believe so, but I'll double check.
At first blush, I didn't think so either.
Okay.
I looked at it more closely.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for coming forward and sharing your stories today. I have no one else that was on the list for 524. I want to ask one more time before we go to our next bill. For all of those who came and was in support here giving testimony today, as well as those who were here and supporting others who were giving testimony, we thank you for being here and sharing your stories and your concerns. Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill.
Just for the record, the list of crimes is rather interesting, what's here and what's omitted. I think it probably will take a fair amount of time to make sure that we're looking at the right. I'm not sure aggravated murder should be on the list, but it is. And some other things aren't on the list that maybe shouldn't be. But anyway.
All righty. Well, thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on 524. We're going to open up our last public hearing on Senate Bill 635. Aaron?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 635 pertains to, there's a general requirement for private security professionals that they comply with a range of certification requirements, including training. And there's already existent in ORS 181871 a wide range of exemptions to that requirement. This would add as a category to be exempted individuals who provide security services as a volunteer at an event operated for the benefit of a nonprofit or federally exempt corporation.
All right, thank you. Teresa, why don't you come on forward? I'm going to go ahead and just put a few things on the record. This issue came to my attention this last summer. DPSST made a visit to the Oregon Country Fair and was checking in with their staff. Based on that conversation and the inquiries they made, an investigation was opened regarding whether or not the fair itself was in compliance with the current statute. The determination at that point was that there was an ongoing investigation, and there was no discussion at that time as to what the impact was. I have a letter from the attorney that represents the fair questioning the application of these statutes to a volunteer working for a nonprofit organization, and I had some discussions with the department, and then they had a second look at the statutes, and at that point it was determined that they felt that the fair was in fact in compliance. But in my discussions with them, it became clear that we thought that it would be worth having clarity to the statute to make certain that nonprofits are not caught up in this. The issue here is also would cover situations such as the Roundup. That's why Dave Nelson is on the bill, because they also use volunteers to put on that event. and then you could actually go to areas such as a if you had a wedding at a church and you had people that were serving as ushers or allowing people to come in under the let's say the original interpretation, it could in fact require those individuals to be certified. Because of the discussions we've had, I want to thank DPSST and Teresa Noggle for her work in clarifying. We felt that it would be appropriate to put within the statutes that these type of organizations that are nonprofit, that are providing events with their own volunteers, would not be caught up in that act. So that's kind of...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, when I first read the bill, I thought this makes total sense, and I saw who was sponsoring it, and then I had to question it, so...
I can understand. You know, Senator Nelson, you always have to be kind of a little leery.
Yes, absolutely.
Teresa.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Noggle, and I am the program manager for the Private Security Private Investigator Unit for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, otherwise known by its acronym as DPSST. DPSST regulates private security providers based on statutory authority and rules established in 1995. Our investigators have attended events in which volunteers were providing these services for some type of consideration for their efforts. And because our governing statutes define in part that anyone performing private security services for consideration need to be certified or licensed, it led to some confusion as to who we were supposed to regulate. This confusion occurred both inside the agency and among our constituency, and we would occasionally receive complaints about unlicensed persons performing security at these events. Senate Bill 635 helps to clarify the original intent of the Private Security Services Providers Act and exempts volunteers who provide services for nonprofit organizations and receive de minimis considerations. There are no fiscal impacts with this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for being here. Again, I want to thank you for the work. Oh, Senator Cruz.
Is there a definition of de minimis? Or, I mean, it's for de minimis, obviously for a little bit, they're getting a little bit, but how are we dealing with that?
I would say from my discussion with the Legislative Council that there has been, let's say, some guidance that has come through statutes and or through case law.
Okay.
Yeah, if I may. Chair Przanski, Senator Cruz, I've had some exposure to this in the past, and the hypothetical, I don't know where the bright line would be, and it is something that you could see litigation on, but I think it's fairly regular for volunteers at these events to receive things like food or T-shirts or something like that. There is a dollar amount that gets bandied around in the case law, and it's pretty low. I just don't know exactly what it is.
Okay. I guess the reason for the question, Mr. Chair, is we're trying to end confusion, and if we throw a term in that's not defined, we are still inserting confusion. But
I understand that this was the, let's say, the term of art that the Legislative Council gave to us, and the discussions with DPSST. Their attorney at the Department of Justice, I think, also came with the same term. So we felt that was appropriate, and then I've had some other people outside of the building who do this area of work look at it and say that was appropriate. So I think at this point, we know what the intent is, and unless someone is actually basically getting paid, or you could show that they're getting, you know, significant, let's say, consideration, I believe this will hopefully give the clarity.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, I know we don't want to have X, Y, and Z necessarily in statute on this,
right.
And I certainly support the intent. I just, the term just kind of went, okay, I don't know what that means, so how do we...
Okay. All right. Again, any other questions? I want to thank you and the director for your assistance in this, and with that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 635, and Council, I think that takes care of everything.
I agree, Chair.
So we will be back here tomorrow. We'll adjourn until tomorrow morning at 8:30, and with that, we're concluded.